This talk was given by Danica Shoan Ankeli at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from Zen Master Hakuin. Buddha means one who is awakened. Once you have awakened, your own mind itself is Buddha. By seeking outside yourself for a Buddha invested with form, you set yourself forward as one who is foolish and misguided. It is like a person who wants to catch a fish. They must start by looking in the water, because fish live in the water and are not found apart from it. If a person wants to find a Buddha, they must look into their own mind, because it is there and nowhere else that Buddha exists. Question. In that case, what do I do to become awakened to my own mind? What is it that asks such a question? Is it your mind? Is it your original nature? Is it some kind of spirit or demon? Is it inside you? Outside you? Is it somewhere intermediate? Is it blue, yellow, red, or white? It is something you must investigate and clarify for yourself. You must investigate it whether you are standing or sitting, speaking or silent, when you are eating your rice or drinking your tea. You must keep at it with single-minded devotion. And never, whatever you do, look in sutras or in commentaries for an answer, or seek it in the words you hear a teacher speak. How do we investigate mind with mind? That's what Zazen practice is. If we want to find a Buddha in our own mind, how do we go about doing that? We have to begin by undoing our ordinary assumptions. This is what every spiritual seeker must do. And Hakuin kindly points out some of our ordinary assumptions right away. That we would, of course, look outside ourselves. That we might listen to the teachers or read the sutras. That we would seek and seek everywhere. But how do we turn like a fish in water and look at our own mind? In the midst of it all the time, completely ordinary, and yet the teachings say there's more. So in Zazen, we take our seat, we let go of all activity. We let all contrivance fall away until that miracle is just stripped bare. There we are, experiencing. What is this experience? Who am I? What is this? The fish in water, ourselves in reality. What is reality? So we need to refine and cultivate our capacity to take what appears obvious and plain before us and not be satisfied with its obviousness. To look again and look again and look more deeply, to really learn how to ask the question and how to uproot all those tendrils of the knowing mind. We all have a question, and that's fundamental to the human experience, but we may not be in touch with it. And sometimes that's a big part of our practice, is actually learning how to connect with and formulate and begin to make enough contact with in a real, honest way for ourselves that we can bring that question out and begin to work with the teacher. Sometimes if we feel like, well, we don't have a question, it might be helpful to just think back in our life to being a child. And if we can, to make that kind of visceral, intuitive contact with some of those feeling states that we might remember from being a kid, could be a sense of a question. It could also just be kind of a general sense of bewilderment. Or wonder. I remember like looking up at the night sky and all those stars and like trying to see if I could see like how deep I could see into the sky. And I was speaking with someone in the Sangha who was saying that as a child, like 10 or 11, he found a book on Zen. And his father was a really devout Christian. And I can't remember the whole anecdote of like how it was that this book came into his hands, but he knew that he was intrigued by it and that it was extremely dangerous in his home. And he had a special spot somewhere in like an outbuilding or I picture it in a shed, I don't know if that's what it was, where he would go and keep this book hidden and go to read it. That longing to find out. Hakuin says, it is like a person who wants to catch a fish. They must start by looking in the water because fish live in the water and are not found apart from it. So if a person wants to find a Buddha, they must look into their own mind because it is there and nowhere else that Buddha exists. So I wanted to explore the water a little bit and look at feelings and inquiry and feeling. How can we use feeling, our feeling states, to investigate Buddha? Our thoughts and our feelings are very related. So as I've been kind of thinking about this, I've been thinking like, that's true for a thought? Is it true for a feeling? If that's true for a feeling, is it true for a thought? And you know, one of the things that was happening for me is kind of like, okay, well, so what's the difference between a thought and a feeling anyway? And like, which one comes first? And I would invite you to consider that perhaps, if not right at this moment, at a future moment. What's arising, right? When irritation comes and we think, oh my God, I can't believe he's doing that again. Which came first? The feeling of irritation or, oh my God, I can't believe he's doing that again. The thought with the feeling hot on its heels. It's kind of interesting. Feelings are so elusive sometimes. And, right, they can be fleeting, ephemeral one like passes through us and like we're not even aware totally that it's there, just suddenly like, you know, we're a little grouchier or a little kinder or a little more upbeat or a little more down, and we don't even know how that happened. So sometimes they're quite slippery, and other times they come and like cover us like a big dark wet blanket and just like wrap us in a state that's unmistakable, right? They can be as gentle as a feather or as relentless as like a bludgeon, both. And the amazing thing about them is they're so personal. It's like impossible to actually give someone a sense of what your feeling is. I mean, you can try, right? And haven't you had that experience where you're like, yeah, I feel like, and you like use words, and if you're very verbal, maybe you get metaphorical, and you're like kind of drawing this whole thing out. And at the end, did you really actually convey the feeling? Or when someone tells you how they're feeling, you're like, yeah, yeah, I know how you feel. And it's like, no, you don't, actually. And you never will. It's incredible. E.E. Cummings, the poet, he said, a poet is somebody who feels and who expresses their feelings through words. This may sound easy. It isn't. A lot of people think or believe they or know they feel, but that's thinking or believing or knowing, not feeling. And poetry is feeling, not thinking or believing or knowing. Almost anybody can learn to think or believe or know, but not a single human being can be taught to feel. Why? Because whenever you think or believe or you know, you're a lot of other people. But the moment you feel, you're nobody but yourself. The Buddha, in his teachings, identified three categories of feeling: good, bad, and neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And we can, you know, and I think sometimes we do in our sort of Western American culture, look down on feelings, not really give them an elevated status. You know, we say like, oh, that's so touchy-feely, or things like that. But if we really look, all of Buddhism, the Dharma that you came here to practice, is all like about feeling, suffering, feeling, and an end to suffering. Feeling is driving, I would hazard to say, all of our human activity. If you think about history and you like really try and trace it back, like all of history is like either monuments or carnage to feeling states, right? Actual people having actual feelings, greed, anger, and ignorance, pride, wanting, craving, fear, all the major wars. I was thinking about it more. I thought, okay, well, so could you say the same thing about the civil rights movement? Have you heard some of those incredible speeches that Dr. King gave? They are so filled with the language of the heart, steeped in feeling. I was thinking about just this past weekend in the March for Our Lives, which a bunch of you were at, which makes me feel really good. And I was thinking also of that quote from Cornel West, who says, justice is what love looks like in public. So we might say, well, justice isn't a feeling, but then we might look more closely. And then if we think about our own life and how feeling has driven our own life, it is very humbling, okay? So think about, like, what have you done in your life to avoid uncomfortable feelings? What have you done in your life to pursue good feelings, pleasant feelings? And then, of course, the Buddha would say, well, so how's that working out for you? So our feelings can rule us, but they are a fickle, and strange kind of despot. We mistake them for ourselves, and so their reign goes unchallenged. And we're in that cycle of samsara, driven by craving. They can be extraordinary, of course, sublime. Think of all of the amazing works of art. Art is the realm of feeling expressed, you might say. And we can't control them. We cannot control them. And part of growing up and maturing is starting to really understand that. We cannot control them. They are, in a sense, ruling our lives. And so it behooves us to really understand them, to see into them. This water that we're swimming in, what is it? I was thinking, you know, even when we begin to see into them, the power is so intense, especially of craving, of desire, of wanting, that seeing into it, like, isn't powerful enough, or at least I have not seen into it deeply enough, I should say, to have met and undone that craving in myself. And just as a little aside, I was working on this talk last night in our office, and Zuiko and I have this stash of chocolate almonds in the closet. And I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna have like a couple chocolate almonds just as a little pick-me-up, like while I'm working on this talk. And I'm really not gonna overdo it because I know that's my tendency. So I took a few out and I put them on the thing. And I'm like, swimming in the water of thinking about feeling, and oh my God, I finished the rest of the chocolate almonds. Zuiko came in later, and that was the first thing I said to her. I was like, I finished all the chocolate almonds. Seeing it, right? Seeing it as it was happening, I still was like, I don't care. So, just to make it perfectly clear, that something is a feeling doesn't diminish it. It doesn't diminish it. Feelings are an opportunity. They're actually a portal to our mind. You could say to the sacred, to the divine. How do they work? Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So the Buddha taught about dependent origination and feeling. Vedana in Sanskrit is part of this cycle that's driving our self and the creation of the self and our life, our karma. It's an integral part. And just to pause for a moment, so we make contact with something. Feeling arises dependent on contact. So we make contact with something, and vedana is a word that refers to both sensation, right, the feeling we might have, the physical feeling, but also it also refers to emotions, so mental feelings that aren't dependent on external contact. Non-sensory feelings that are generated internally, in Gunaratana's words. So arising in contact, they're there, they're sustained for a period of time, and then they pass away, and that's really important to appreciate. And being a feeling sentient being, you know this, right? How many feelings have you had since you woke up this morning? Or even since Kinhin, if you want to get subtler about it. So they arise in contact, And then when the conditions change, the feeling changes. Something else comes along, we have another kind of contact. Could be a thought also. And or it just passes away because we're not feeding it. And so within our Zazen practice and within the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, there's a great emphasis on learning how to be aware of your feelings. And as we become aware of our feelings, Gunaratana says, this is from the Foundations of Mindfulness by Bhante Gunaratana, watching how quickly our feelings change, without any effort on our part, we realize an important truth. We begin to see that feelings are just feelings, not my feelings or part of me. We realize that we often identify so closely with our feelings that they seem to be part of our basic identity. We say, my knee hurts whenever I sit down to meditate, or I am angry about the government, as if these feelings were unchanging parts of a self that is also permanent, everlasting, and immutable. But if our feelings were identical with the self and the self were permanent, then our feelings of pain and anger should also be permanent. Experience tells us that this is not the case. Feelings change, and our so-called self has no control over the changes. Observing this, we see very clearly that the self cannot be a permanent entity. I think there's a little bit of a leap there from my own experience. But still, extremely helpful in the path of inquiry to see the changing nature of feeling. So a feeling arises, it peaks, it passes away. We can't control it. In Zazen, we are not trying to control our feelings, right? We're not trying to make like, oh, this really good feeling state. I know in some schools of meditation, it's taught that you should have like a gentle, light smile upon your face. And I've tried that, and I do see that it does something, you know, just that physical expression has an effect. But I also feel like, well, wait a second. We're not trying to manufacture like, So, you know, I don't know. I'm glad we don't practice that way here. So how do we now let our feelings, now that we're becoming aware of them and mindful of them and can see that they arise, they peak, and they pass away, how can we actually let this be part of a deeper inquiry? As Gunaratana says, we see, okay, my feelings are changing. Maybe this means also that myself is not permanent. But there's another part of investigating that I feel like Hakuin brings out really nicely. When he asks, you know, what is it that asks such a question? What is it that asks that question? Who is it? Who is it that's having that feeling? Who is it? To find out, we need to get really close. So when we're sitting, we can actually let ourselves have our feelings, not attach, right? So this is part of our Zazen skill, is that we don't want to jump onto the feeling and start riding it into the sunset. No, the feeling comes and we're going to let it peak and pass away. So we're learning a little bit of mindfulness, spacious distance there. And Joko Beck, Charlotte Joko Beck, she was Daito Roshi's elder Dharma sister, trained at ZCLA. And she has a really nice piece in her book, Everyday Zen, where she talks about She has two chapters side by side, what practice isn't and what practice is. And they're so, she's so great. She's so like no nonsense, nitty gritty, just like breaks it down for you. She's one of the first Dharma teachers whose books I read, and I just really felt such a connection. And I still like to go back to them. So she talks about what practice is. Once we've assumed our best posture, which should be balanced and easy, we just sit there. We do zazen. What do I mean by just sit there? It's the most demanding of all activities. She says, all sorts. So what's going on? You just sit there. What's going on? All sorts of things. A tiny twitch in your left shoulder. A pressure in your side. Notice your face for a moment. Feel it. Is it tense? Around the mouth, around the forehead? Move down a bit. Notice your neck. Feel it. And she moves this way, kind of systematically, which is interesting. Don't try to control it, she says, just feel it. Just let your breath be as it is. Just experience it as it is. Feel all that. If a car goes by outside, hear it. If a plane flies over, notice it. Just be that. That's all you have to do. If you can just do that for about 3 minutes, it's a miracle. Usually after about 1 minute, we begin to think. Our interest in just being with reality, which is what we have just done, is very low. So as she's describing just being with our experience, you know, as we're working with our mind and our body and our feeling states in session, we can really work with getting closer to our experience. And leaving the words behind. So rather than trying to name our feelings, to just be with them, rather than trying to describe our breath to ourselves or notice things about it, to really just be intimate with it. And get so close, how close, merge. So close. Be one with. So then a feeling stops being a feeling. We're doing a body practice, the residence with Fusei, who's a Sangha member and a movement instructor, and she's had us do several exercises which are new to me, and where we're asked to pay very close attention to our physical experience. The one I'm thinking of in particular, we had 8 minutes to go from standing to lying on the floor, moving extremely slowly and paying minute attention to every aspect of that movement. And, you know, my attention wavered, but for parts of it, I felt extremely connected. 8 minutes is a chunk of time. And, you know, I felt like, whoa, like, when does my body stop being my body? How close can we get to our experience? And, of course, that's the instruction offered if you're working with physical pain during zazen, is to let yourself get inside and be completely with it. And don't call it pain. As we are working with feelings in this way, or thoughts in this way, or sensations in this way, and we see, you know, we may come in and come out and come in and come out, and we start to get a sense of like, whoo. Things dissolve. I think of that book by Milan Kundera that I read years ago, and I really don't remember anything about it except for the title, The Unbearable lightness of being. And I think sometimes about that, how the lightness actually of ourself, as we begin to let it go, is sometimes unbearable. I find it difficult. I often feel like that's one of my big obstructions in practice, is I'm like, no, actually, I like the self. I don't want to give it up. I know there's been so much suffering, but I'm enamored, right? Don't we do that? Clinging, we call it. So again, mind looking at mind, being completely close, intimate with our feeling states. This is how we learn to empty out. This is how we learn to appreciate emptiness. And I did a hermitage not long ago, and with me I brought some short, pithy teachings by Patril Rinpoche, who's a 19th century Tibetan Dzogchen master. And Dzogchen is a meditation style that's really, really similar to Zazen, particularly Shikantaza. And I brought it with me because I knew, first I had the encouragement of my teacher to maybe bring something that might be helpful, something lean was the phrase. And so I thought, okay, something that will help me if I need some guidance. And so I brought this, and I was thinking about it. I used it a lot. I found it extremely helpful. And then I was thinking, like, I was really thinking of it when I was working with it as working with the mind and thoughts. But as I said earlier, mind, thoughts, mind, feelings, thoughts, feelings, it's all in there. So he says, within a state of relaxation of body and mind, look right at whatever thought arises and relax directly into that itself. When another thought arises, relax directly into it, as before. Do not rejoice when thought has vanished into emptiness, and do not see it as problematic when it multiplies. Do not entertain either hope for meditation to go well or fear that it will not occur well. Relax right into whatever arises. Whatever thoughts arise, whatever appears, it is all the play of pristine wisdom. This is the emptiness that is the profound perspective of all victorious ones. Relaxing into a feeling, can we relax into it enough? That it self-liberates. And to see that feelings are empty, we get into the tricky territory of sometimes privileging, at least in our minds, in our philosophical arena, emptiness over form, right? So we could think, well, so feelings are empty, so they don't really matter. So like, if I hurt your feelings, it doesn't really matter. You should just get over it because they're empty. But feelings are also form. And the whole of our practice is asking us to stop separating and making dualistic. Feelings matter. Of course they matter. If anything matters, then feelings matter. And if nothing matters, that's not Zen practice. Zen practice is everything matters. So hurting someone's feelings is serious. That's creating evil. Helping someone's feelings is serious. That's actualizing good for others. We had a Beyond Fear of Differences meeting with the residents just really recently. And this is work where we're studying bias and oppression and power and privilege, and trying to use our Dharma practice to free ourselves and illuminate those bonds, and also trying to look at our own MRO culture and see how are we oppressing each other and freeing each other, and are we aware? And so we're looking explicitly at race and gender. That's what we've been looking at to begin with. And so in our most recent meeting, we were sharing, we were taking up the subject of how you have a conversation around a difficult topic, particularly like race. And if someone says something that's racially insensitive, how do we create a culture here at the monastery where we can take that up so that we can start to heal those wounds? And so the question of feelings and hurting people's feelings, and who's responsible when someone's feelings get hurt. And I shared in my pair, we were invited to share an experience of being on either side of the fence, so to speak, of saying something insensitive, particularly around race or gender. And so I shared this recent, embarrassingly recent story of I was at the temple, and a really good friend of mine who's in the Sangha was staying overnight. She lives in Harlem, so she had to travel far to come to the temple. She was going to do the retreat on Saturday, and so she was going to spend the night so she didn't have to travel so far. And Hojin Sensei and I were helping make up a bed for her with her in the Sangha room, and we were chatting and having a nice time. And she was starting to freak out about cockroaches, and she was like, "Do you guys have roaches at the temple? Oh my God, oh my God." And we're like, "No, we don't, we don't." And this tiny little bug crawled across the bed, and she was like, "Oh my God, there it is, it's a roach." And so here comes my racially insensitive moment. So notice feelings that may arise for you as I say this. I said, "Girl, don't tell me you're from Harlem and you don't know what a cockroach looks like. That is not a cockroach." Okay, that, I was called out on that immediately. Thank you, Hojin Sensei, and thank you to my dear friend, who turned to me and said, "Shoan, that's racist." And I was immediately defensive. And I'm like, "I grew up on the edge of Harlem. We had roaches in our apartment. I could have said that about da, 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 da." All true. But am I really appreciating what's happening in that moment? How that sounded to her? Coming from me, a white woman? When we're in a moment like that and we're called out, I mean, you know, my defensiveness was my first turn to. And we need to do a better job. We need to do a better job, particularly if we're the one who is coming from the cultural position of power and privilege. And to bring this back to feelings, I would say, like, in that moment, we need to make a choice that the other person's feelings are more important than ours. So yeah, sure, I feel uncomfortable or defensive, or like, you totally misunderstood, you don't have, but in that moment, right, like, what's happening, I was thinking about it, and it feels like, it's like, if we're real about our life and time and place that we live in, we are like riding this tsunami that is huge, that is stretching way back in time. If I'm, as a white person, what is behind me? What centuries of power and privilege are carrying me into this present body and mind? If I'm a person of color, what is that wave? So in that moment, I can make a choice. I can make a choice. Your feelings are more important to me. I am sorry. And that moment at the temple went by pretty fast and quick and really pretty easy. I did get back in touch with this person after, reflecting on it, just to check in and be like, you know, is there more? Should we talk about this? And she felt okay about it. But, you know, we had a close friendship, so we had that to rely on. But, you know, in a moment, what if I hadn't really known her and that had come out of my mouth? What if somebody else had said something insensitive while she was there? And that and the other, and pretty soon, before you know it, this person is like, you know what, thanks, I'm not going to be staying here. And maybe they go to another Dharma center, and maybe they don't. And so in the context of our Sangha, it's so important. I mean, it's important, it's important, it's important all the way down to the bottom. But as seekers of the way, don't we know how precious it is to find a place to practice and a Sangha to practice with? How awful to ignorantly, blindly put something in the way for somebody else. You know, so at our residence meeting, some folks shared in the times that followed, and even in the meeting itself a little bit, about feeling like, okay, well, now I feel like I can't say anything. I can't say anything because I might hurt someone's feelings. And you know, maybe it's okay if you have to be really careful for a little while. That's how we learn. Maybe that's fine. So, what is it that asks such a question? Is it your mind? Is it your original nature? Is it inside you, outside you? Is it somewhere intermediate? To get there to that question is our practice. I was thinking, when you walk outside and you can tell spring is coming, is that a feeling? How do we know? Who's feeling that? Who is it?
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.